Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Accidental Activists, Mark Ferris, Vic Holmes, and Their Fight for Marriage Equality in Texas, by David Collins. Foreword by Evan Wolfson and Julian Castro. Narrated by James Patrick Cronin. Foreword. On June 26, 2015, more than four decades of struggle and engagement, combat and persuasion, activism and conversation culminated in a Supreme Court ruling affirming the freedom to marry for all Americans, including same-sex couples like Vic Holmes and Mark Ferris, whose story David Collins recounts with impressive empathy in this book. More than a million gay people have legally married in the United States, and a supermajority of Americans, more than 60%, support the freedom to marry and are proud that our country lived up to its promise and became, through all that hard work and hope, battling and belief, a more perfect union. How did this historic transformation and triumph happen? Well, four decades of work means it didn't happen overnight. The climax in the Supreme Court, of course, means it took lawyers, litigation, and hundreds of plaintiffs, like Mark and Vic. It also took battles in state legislatures and in Congress, millions of conversations and millions of dollars raised and invested. It took courageous elected officials and determined constituents helping to push them and create space in which they could rise. It took many organizations and allies. It took a movement, a strategy, and a campaign, freedom to marry. And it took we, the people, everyday Americans willing to trust that others could rise to fairness, people willing to share their stories, engage in conversations and persuasion, provide both information and an appeal to shared values, the heartfelt truths of our lives. Conversation is the chief engine of change in a country like America. And as the book sums it up so well, we needed accidental activists willing to lead good and productive lives, tell your stories, engage the people around you, but do so quietly, in conversational terms. Respect those who stand opposed. Give them time and the psychological space they need to grow, to discover their better selves and to become supporters. This essential engagement worked. It created space for business and labor, voices of faith and advocates for children, political leaders and former opponents to open their hearts and minds and move. It created space for the political successes and litigation victories that hard work delivered and that cumulatively created the climate for triumph in the Supreme Court. LGBT Americans have won the freedom to marry in law, but of course, the marriage conversation has only just begun to penetrate some parts of the country, some communities, including, yes, some in Texas. The freedom to marry remains the gift that keeps on giving. By giving more and more people the chance to hear the stories, see the joy and needs of their fellow Americans, the power of the marriage conversation continues to build greater understanding of gay and transgender people. Greater visibility and showing shared values increases empathy and adds momentum to the urgent work still ahead. That work includes ending discrimination and exclusion in other important arenas, such as employment, housing, education, and places of public accommodation, such as businesses and, yes, even bathrooms. It includes making sure that people's actual lived experience is good, not just the laws, but their actual lives. Young people growing up safe, accepted, and free to dream big. Older people finding support and facilities for care without being forced back into the closet because of who they are and whom they love. All Americans, free and equal, and able to pursue happiness in every state, every community. And it includes defending our country's hard-won gains against efforts to divide Americans, demean communities, undermine progress, or roll back the clock. In 2014, on the day Judge Orlando Garcia heard arguments in De Leon v. Perry, the case Mark and Vic and another courageous couple, Cleopatra De Leon and Nicole Dimmitman, brought against Texas, we partnered on an op-ed in the San Antonio Express News. We wrote, "The moral question on the table is, do we treat others as we would want to be treated? Aren't we all striving to follow the golden rule without succumbing to divisiveness and discrimination? Aren't we all God's children? We think that most Americans and most Texans would agree. The answer is a resounding yes. The discussion around dinner tables is about the right to marry, not what churches can or cannot do. Churches and other religious institutions will always be free, as they are now, to decide whom they want to marry. Religious freedom, like equal protection and the freedom to marry, is a bedrock constitutional principle of this great country. But the government should not discriminate. Like the majority of Americans nationwide, we believe in individual responsibility and the pursuit of happiness, and know that freedom means freedom for all. Accidental Activists is the touching story of Mark and Vic's love and commitment, a moving account of their willingness to work and fight to defend America's values. David Collins captures the couple's talk of family and of their fears, traces the difficulties they confronted, and stirringly conveys the determination that carried them through difficult moments, the ups and downs of facing a big no from so many parts of society and turning it not just into a yes, but an I do. As we move through 2017 and into the future, America faces some tough times, domestic as well as foreign threats. Once again, too many in power are falling far short of the values and promise that make America great. Once again, we are all called to take action to get our country back on track, much as Mark and Vic and millions like them had to do at a time when winning the freedom to marry was dismissed as appalling or laughable, dangerous, and doomed. David Collins calls Mark and Vic accidental activists, but as Aristotle said long ago, the ideal man bears the accidents of life with dignity and grace, making the best of circumstances. It took hope, clarity, and tenacity to win the freedom to marry, and all of us must now step up and meet the challenges of this moment to defend our republic and fight against bad policies, bad politics, bad politicians. We must all be activists now, and must do so with trust we can win, not cynicism. Belief that others can rise, not despair. Commitment to America's constitutional and moral values, not surrender. This book offers lessons for effective action, and it offers hope. That is the start of winning. That is what is needed now. Julian Castro, Evan Wolfson. Julian Castro was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and the Mayor of San Antonio. Evan Wolfson was founder and president of Freedom to Marry. Author's Preface. By at least one way of reckoning, this book began in the fall of 1978 at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. When classes began that year, I was a newly tenured, newly promoted associate professor of English, determined that the world would, or at least should, share my love of Shakespeare. But as I walked in the still intense heat of August from my office to the room where I would meet my first class of the semester, I was thinking less about Shakespeare than about making the world safe for English grammar, about the importance of pre-writing, and the link between clear thinking and clear writing. The students waiting for me had signed up for English 104 Academic Writing, a required course few students in those days escaped. Another year had begun, my 13th year teaching in one or another college or university. I knew from long experience that great hopes, great expectations, great joys, and no doubt a few disappointments would follow. Just over 20 faces looked up as I entered the classroom and took the place traditionally left for the instructor at the head of the large oval table that reached nearly to the four walls. In the next academic year, Westminster would admit its first ever class of women. But in the fall of 1978, the faces that turned expectantly toward me belonged exclusively to young men. Introducing myself, searching their faces as I talked about what would come, I looked for distinguishing marks that would help me to associate names with faces. Only one really stood out, a function of his light-skinned, freckled face, topped by a shock of red hair that drew the eye. His name, I would soon learn, was Mark Ferris. In those long-ago days before the fabled gentleman's C became the gentleman's B and evolved later into the gentleman's A, Few students in academic writing at Westminster earned more than a C on their first essay. Most improved steadily as the semester wore on, but that first experience was intended as a shot across the bow, a sign to incoming students that standards in college would be considerably higher than what most had experienced in high school. The real test was how any given student would react to his lower-than-expected grade. When I returned the first set of essays that fall, Mark Ferris looked at his and found among the comments at the end the standard C. Alarmed, perhaps a little angry, he had graduated fifth in his high school class of almost 600 and had never gotten a C on any academic exercise, he made his way to my office the next day. Already a history buff, he had chosen Westminster in part because Winston Churchill had delivered his famous Iron Curtain speech there in 1946, in part because its unusually low faculty-student ratio promised an opportunity to work closely with faculty. A generous scholarship had made his enrollment possible, and he was determined that nothing would endanger that scholarship. Rather than grouse about unreasonable demands, he chose to take advantage of that low faculty-student ratio and stopped by to understand what he needed to do to improve his writing. That day he passed the first test by which faculty measure students. We talked that afternoon and many afternoons after that. I came quickly to realize that Mark was the student every professor dreams of. Smart, serious, hard-working, and yet funny. I was impressed, so much so that 2 years later when I sat on a committee charged with choosing the recipient of the Cranshaw Scholarship, Westminster's most prestigious award for study abroad, I convinced my colleagues that the coveted prize should go to Mark. I must have impressed him as well, since he quickly got over the disappointment of that first C. Semester after semester, he appeared in one or another of my classes. We got to know each other well, or so I thought. I learned a great deal about Mark's family, about his life in Oklahoma, about his ambition for a life in the law. What I didn't learn then, or for many years to come, was that Mark was gay. One of the great virtues of small liberal arts colleges like Westminster is that faculty-student friendships often grow into lifelong friendships, and that happened with Mark and me. After 4 years, he sailed off to law school at Vanderbilt, settled in San Antonio to practice law, moved on and up in the legal profession. But always he came back to Westminster. Whenever he did, he sought me out, and our conversations picked up where they had left off. When Facebook came along, our interactions became more frequent. I retired at the end of May 2013, and in the winter before that, another alum organized a banquet to celebrate my 40 years of service at Westminster. Mark was one of half a dozen all-time favorite students I insisted be invited to that celebration. I knew by then that Mark was gay, knew that he was already working to defend the rights of gays and lesbians in Texas. Still, my knowledge was incomplete. I had no idea how far he was willing to take the battle. Within 6 months of my retirement, the story told in this book began in earnest. Toward the end of October 2013, Mark posted on Facebook that he and his partner, Vic Holmes, together with Cleopatra De Leon and Nicole Dimmitman, had filed suit against Texas. Mark and Vic wanted the right to marry, denied them by statutory and constitutional law in Texas. Nicole and Cleo wanted their legal marriage, performed in Massachusetts, recognized in Texas. For a year, I followed Mark and Vic's posts and comments closely, reading what they sent, commenting on occasion, sending words of encouragement when that seemed necessary. Though separated by hundreds of miles, as many miles as separate Missouri and Texas, I celebrated with Mark and Vic and Cleo and Nicole when a decision from the Federal District Court for the Western District of Texas declared Texas's bans against same-sex marriage unconstitutional. I grieved with them when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals delayed and delayed again in setting a date for oral arguments on Texas's appeal. Though on occasion Mark or Vic would raise the lid and I was able to catch in their comments a glimpse of what they were feeling, most of what I heard that first year was merely informative. But in the fall of 2014, something changed. Where occasional posts about marriage equality had once been balanced by other posts, photos of and stories about their travels or their beloved beagles, artful photographs of wildlife or wild places they had visited, family pictures from long ago, and warm vignettes of family life in the present, celebrations of or laments for the fortunes of the Oklahoma Sooners football team, always rising or falling, in October and November, as the struggle for marriage equality in Texas and across the nation heated up, most posts focused on new developments in the struggle he and Vic had joined. 4 and 5 posts a day, sometimes 6 and even 7. The drumbeat summoning supporters to prepare for a decisive battle had clearly begun. When, on November 20th, 2014, Mark posted an announcement from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, they had at last set January 9th as the date for oral arguments in the Texas case, I sent a private message congratulating Mark and Vic on their courage and promising whatever support I could offer from a distance. Unable to shake entirely my old role as professor of English, the habits of 40 years die hard, I added the usual injunction to write it all down. I hope you're keeping a journal, I told Mark, since this is going to make a great book. Minutes later, Mark messaged me. Are you busy? He asked. Can I call you? We talked that afternoon as we had talked so often before. Mark had only one question. Why don't you write the book? I hadn't been the first to suggest a book about his and Vic's still-developing story, Mark told me. At first, they had dismissed the suggestion. What had they done, they wondered. What could they do that would be of interest to a general audience? But as the number of people imagining a book grew, their minds had changed. My suggestion had come in a fortunate hour. Moreover, Mark knew my writing and trusted me. I had other projects in hand, had begun revising a series of essays published over the years in literary magazines for publication as a collection. That done, I had planned to finish a book of walking tours of sites in Paris made famous by American writers who lived and wrote there from the end of the First World War to the present. And I had already roughed out a novel set in Paris. I had projects aplenty. But the idea of writing about marriage equality, of telling the story of the struggle for same-sex marriage through the lives of two ordinary men who, finding themselves at a crossroads, found, as well, the courage to move along the road no one in Texas had yet dared to follow, was compelling. I talked with Jean, my wife. We flew to Texas to learn more. That weekend, we met Vic, came to understand at least a bit of why Mark loved him, and learned the outlines of his story. Very different from Mark's, but no less compelling. Jean and I had long numbered other gay men and lesbians among our friends. They had talked with us about the indignities so often heaped on people in the LGBT community, problems with jobs, housing, families. Some had shared difficult coming-out stories. But listening to Mark and Vic speak of homophobia in the legal profession, in the armed services, in Texas, much of it condoned and even encouraged by law, brought home the need for change in a whole new way. I was hooked. Their story needed to be written and deserved to be written well. But as we talked our way through the weekend, questions arose, at least in my own mind. Would my heterosexuality be an issue? Could a straight man write effectively about the experience of two gay men fighting for what I had taken for granted my entire life, the right to marry the person they loved most in all the world? Was my experience too different? The more I thought, the more I came to understand my perspective as an advantage, a twofold advantage. Though I hadn't lived the lives Mark and Vic had lived, couldn't identify entirely with them, I realized quickly that what seemed in one moment an obstacle appeared in the next as an advantage. My perspective would enable me to stand at once inside and outside, to tell the whole story in a way they could not. More important, perhaps, I knew that a writer's job is to enter into the lives of other people. Some villains, some heroes, some sympathetic, some condemnable, some projections of the author's self, some very different, and to make the audience feel what they feel. That I had done before, and knew I could do again. That weekend I wondered as well about difference. Mark and Vic knew full well that not everyone in the LGBT community was of one mind about the desirability of marriage. As Cleve Jones writes in When We Rise, the debate that began in the late 1960s continues still. Each generation has employed a different vocabulary, he suggests, but the issue remains essentially unchanged. Are we a queer and distinct people, with revolutionary potential born from our experiences? Or are we really just like everyone else, except for what we do in bed? Though Mark and Vic recognized, even sympathized with the opposing view, they had come down on the side of marriage. Likeness over difference. As boys and young men, difference had been thrust upon them, a razor-sharp blade that inflicted 1,000 cuts. They had struggled to create authentic selves, struggled to achieve what, in Romer v. Evans, Lawrence v. Texas, and United States v. Windsor, Justice Anthony Kennedy refers to consistently as personhood, too often denied to gays and lesbians. In their eyes, marriage was an important signifier, a cultural rite de passage that signaled social acceptance. Two members of the community had come together as one in the ultimate expression of love and commitment. Not everyone in the gay community, Mark and Vic recognized, may want to marry. But they were determined that, as recognition of their essential humanity, the opportunity ought to be available for those who do. Moreover, they recognized that choosing likeness over difference, choosing to fight for the right to marry, brought with it an additional advantage. As Justice Breyer would point out the day Obergefell was argued, the Constitution and Amendment 14 does say you cannot deprive a person of liberty, certainly of basic liberty, without due process of law, and that to take a group of people where so little distinguish them from the people you give liberty to, and not let them participate in this basic institution, that violates the 14th Amendment. The right to marry wasn't the beginning of the struggle for gay rights. It wouldn't be the end. But for Mark and Vic, the right to marry was an important way station on the road to full equality, and the likely road there ran through likeness. Listening as Mark and Vic talked of their lives, of the plans they hoped to make real, I recognized that we were not different in any meaningful way. If, as a straight man, I had not experienced all that they had experienced, could not identify entirely with them, I could identify with them in all that mattered. The desire to be recognized as an autonomous human being with inalienable rights, part of a larger community. By the time I boarded a plane to return to Missouri, I knew how I would spend the next year or so. Writing the story Mark and Vic had lived since birth and continued to live as I watched sent me on a great adventure, a personal voyage of discovery. That first weekend, I recorded hours and hours of conversation. For 2 years, I talked almost daily with one or both men. We exchanged countless emails and text messages as I discovered what I did know, what I didn't know, and worked to fill in the gaps, reaching always not just to record, not just to understand, but to feel their experience and, I hope, to enable the audience to do the same. I combed through emails between lawyers and plaintiffs, read briefs and court decisions that introduced me to a whole new vocabulary. I read widely, and I hope well, plunging for hours into books that would provide background for the still-developing story of their lives as gay men and their challenge to Texas. As the battle for marriage equality in Texas and across the nation developed, I combed the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Advocate, and the gay press generally for relevant stories. I watched as Mark and Vic and their friends on Facebook reacted to each victory, each loss. I traveled with Mark and Vic to New Orleans when the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals heard De Leon v. Perry. I watched and listened the night before at the Cathedral Creative Studies as Mark and Vic, Cleo and Nicole, together with plaintiffs from Louisiana and Mississippi, told their stories and reached out to support each other. I accompanied them to Washington, D.C. as the fight for marriage equality entered its final phase, listened with them as Evan Wolfson, the godfather of same-sex marriage, and Valerie Jarrett, one of President Obama's most trusted aides, spoke encouragingly to plaintiffs in same-sex marriage cases from around the country, sat with them in the Supreme Court the next day As Mary Bonato and Solicitor General Donald Varelli argued for their rights in Obergefell v. Hodges. When they married at last in Frisco, Texas, I was there, watching, listening, still working my way chapter by chapter toward a book that would do justice to their story. The parallel story of Nicole and Cleo, co-plaintiffs in DeLeon v. Perry, a different but no less compelling story, deserves its own book. Encouraged by Ron Chrisman, director of the University of North Texas Press, I submitted a chapter from the still-developing manuscript, Accidental Activists, Mark Ferris, Vic Holmes, and Their Fight for Marriage Equality in Texas, to the 2016 Book Manuscript Contest sponsored by the Frank W. and Sue Mayborn Foundation, and awarded at the Mayborn Literary Nonfiction Conference. The judges smiled on my efforts. At the conference in late July, Accidental Activists won first place and a contract for publication with the University of North Texas Press. In mid-September, I sent the completed manuscript to the press. By December, I had the reports in hand and had begun to revise. At the end of January 2017, I returned a new, much improved version to the press. And as I worked through the months between September and January, the election of Donald Trump as President of the United States turned the world in which Mark and Vic married upside down. No one had imagined that winning the right to marry would end forever the debate over gay rights. 3 weeks to the day before the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Obergefell, Michelangelo Signorelli's It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality, appeared in bookstores. Imagine a group of people, he asked in the spring of 2015, who have spent decades, generations, centuries in fear, invisibility, silence. Now imagine that, in a matter of a few short years, everything seems to change. At what feels like light speed, they make momentous gains. The world begins to open its arms to them in ways they had never thought possible. The experience is powerful, exhilarating, spellbinding even. But beneath the glittering surface, Signorelli warned the audience, LGBT and straight allies alike, there lurks a reality more treacherous than many imagine. We have arrived, he claimed, at a dangerous moment in which victory blindness imperils recent gains. A year and more later, at the White House Pride reception in June 2016, President Obama sounded the same note. Don't ask, don't tell had been repealed. The Matthew Shepard hate crimes bill had been signed into law. LGBT Americans had won the right to marry. But progress, he warned, isn't inevitable. History doesn't just travel forward. It can go backwards if we don't work hard. Though in the summer of 2016, even dyed-in-the-wool optimists recognized that the fight for equality was far from over and were inclined to listen to the prudent voices advising caution. Few imagined that in the November elections, Republicans would retain control of the House and the Senate, and that Donald Trump would win the presidency. Suddenly, the possibility that history could and would move quickly backward seemed not just possible, but probable. Though Trump claimed during the campaign that he was not anti-LGBT, he chose as his running mate Governor Mike Pence, the man who signed and stubbornly defended SB 101, the toxic Religious Freedom Restoration Act that shattered Indiana's open-for-business reputation. Senior staff picks and nominees for cabinet positions sent a similar message. Steve Bannon, poised to take up residence in the West Wing as Trump's chief strategist and senior counselor, telegraphed his attitude toward gay rights when, as chairman of Breitbart News, he passed on stories with titles like Gay Rights Have Made Us Dumber, It's Time to Get Back in the Closet, and Day of Silence, How the LGBT Agenda is Hijacking America's Youth. Betsy DeVos, Trump's pick for Secretary of Education, claimed during her confirmation hearings that paperwork listing her for 17 years as vice president of the Edgar and Elsa Prince Foundation, a generous donor of anti-LGBT groups like Focus on the Family and the Family Research Council, was the result of a clerical error, but few were convinced. Ben Carson, Trump's choice for housing and urban development, denied during the campaign that gay rights are civil rights, asserted that being gay is a choice, and compared gay sex to bestiality. Most frightening of all was Senator Jeff Sessions, Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Department of Justice, whose long and well-documented history opposed...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?